supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. I'm Larry Roebling. The headlines tell us the opioid epidemic is dire, and there is definitely cause for great concern. But beyond the headlines, there is some hope. Today, Dr. Dan brings together professionals, parents, and individuals in recovery to remind us that treatment can lead to a sober life with new purpose. But first, Bruce and Ginny Murray tell their story about losing their son Alex to the disease of addiction and their work to help others.
Bruce Murray, first of all, I want to offer my condolences to you and your wife Ginny, who's also here with us, on the loss of your youngest son Alex. I am so very sorry.
Thank you.
Your nightmare begins when you received a call that Alex got into a DUI.
Right.
Take the story from there.
Alex grew up in our family, which was a pretty run-of-the-mill, stable family, and two older brothers. We found out that he used alcohol and pot, and we weren't happy about it, and he knew that. But in 2008, he had his first DUI, and that was when we found out that he was already addicted to opiates. Many families don't even realize how serious the addiction problem is for the person that they love who suffers from the disease. So it was literally for us going from living a pretty good upper middle class professional life with not that many problems to suddenly finding ourselves facing a nightmare. You go into panic, chaos, histrionics. We were lucky our son went to treatment right away. He took our family through the roller coaster. I tell people, you know, I had no experience with the police besides a speeding ticket until this all happened, and then I had to find out about how to deal with the police and with prison and judges and courts and pawn shops and nightmarish things that I never could have imagined. He did get treatment, medical treatment with Suboxone. And it helped him for a few months, and then he started abusing it and selling it. My wife and I did go to Narnon. He did get into a 12-step program at NA. He did get a very good year in 2011 of sobriety and recovery. He gained back everything that he'd lost and then some, and it was a wonderful year. But he relapsed very badly in 2012. And on Father's Day weekend, he died from a heroin overdose.
How are you?
It's been 4 years since he died, and I'm okay. I've learned to manage the grief, and my wife and I have done a great deal of hard work to be able to manage that. You know, the other part, I think, that goes with addiction is it's like losing them twice, because when you find out they're an addict, you go into grief then. Again, I say with respect to all the people I know who suffer with other maladies, I say it cautiously because I don't mean to offend anybody, but when somebody you love gets cancer, they don't steal from you, they don't call you terrible names, they don't disappear for months on end. The chaos and the horror is, I'm going to say it, almost as bad as having lost him to death when it finally happened. But to your point, to your question, we're okay.
We were talking about 12-step programs. You were in Narnon.
Yes.
Did that help you?
We're still very active in Narnon. We joined it right after we found out that Alex suffered from addiction. And it's a 12-step anonymous program. I guess you'd say auxiliary to NA. In a sense, for family and loved ones of people who suffer from addiction. And it saved my life, absolutely saved my life.
How?
It was liberating, knowing nothing until that point in my life about addiction, to find out that other families were going through exactly the same thing. Everybody's story was different circumstances, but the reality for us and the way we now had to live our life, it felt good to have our feelings about the horror show validated.
Ginny, I want to say the same thing to you that I said, you know, to Bruce previously. I am sorry.
Thank you
for your loss. So, how are all four of you doing? You know, I asked Bruce how he was doing. I want to know how you're doing and your other sons, brothers.
For myself, I most of the time I'm doing okay. There's always flashbacks and, you know, remembering, and I try to just remember good times. As far as his brothers, they were all close, but one was closer than the other, and he was affected more deeply. And he will talk about it with us if we want to. The other one has our two grandchildren, and he's kind of the closed-lipped type person. He holds it all in. And his wife can't even get him to talk about it. But he has his way of dealing with the grief. He's not one for talking about it, even though he's a lawyer, and you would think he would be talking a lot.
Not like that.
Mm-mm.
You know, I always say, Jenny, the deeper the love, the deeper the pain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the effect on parents, on loved ones, we don't talk about PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that experience?
In the beginning, yeah.
Bruce, when I asked your wife that question, you nodded very vigorously. You feel
yes.
You have it?
Absolutely. Alex was a great woodworker, and 4 years later, I can walk through Lowe's, through the tool department, and still feel the hair in the back of my neck go up and a lump in my throat, and it... Not like it was the first year, but it's still there. And the triggers are everywhere.
Jenny, at Alex's funeral, mm-hmm. your friend's sister, who lost her brother to addiction, said something to you. What did she say?
I don't remember exactly, but pretty much just don't stop living. Because when her parents lost her two brothers, they pretty much stopped, and she didn't have a family anymore. Her parents just closed off everything, and it was very meaningful, and we were, you know, glad that she said that.
So what have you done? How are you living?
How are we living?
You're doing a lot of work.
We are. We do what we can. Sometimes it's overload, but I... started a group that is for grieving parents or grieving anyone grieving the loss of someone who overdosed. It's called GRASP, which means Grief Recovery After Substance Passing. It was started years ago by a couple whose daughter had passed, and they found that there was no group for parents who their child overdosed, because there's the stigma, and if you go to another grieving group that lost children, you're looked down upon. And so there was a couple of groups in our area, and I felt that there should be more, because there's always somebody calling.
How can we find out about it?
There's a website, www.grasphelp.org. There's a lot of information on there and where there are meetings all around the country.
Ginny, Bruce, thank you. I want to talk about what is being done and what the good news is here. Listen, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the opioid epidemic. The news is often pretty grim, or what we hear is pretty grim, but there is hope of recovery. We're learning more. There's new breakthroughs. Here to talk about that is Dr. Kimberly Kirby. She's a senior scientist at the Treatment Research Institute. And Charles Wolfe, he's the director of outpatient services at Livengren. Later on, we're going to talk to some individuals and their own personal experience with the disease and what we can learn from them. Charlie, you know, what we're hearing from Bruce brings up a couple of issues here. The most important in my mind is the issue of relapse. And it's pretty common, relapse. And we're hearing this horror story from Bruce that sometimes it's fatal, but sometimes it's not. And sometimes is it actually improve the prognosis if someone has a relapse and gets back into treatment?
Anytime someone can reengage in treatment or recovery or their recovery program that they were engaged in, with the motivation and the fervor that they once did, if not more, sure, their prognosis, their chances of having successful recoveries, if you want to use that term, or remission, grow exponentially.
Is this true for adolescents, Kimberly?
One of the things that's pretty clear is that when somebody's in treatment, they're generally better off than when they are not in treatment. That's good. And it's a cycling door for adolescents as well. So they'll go into treatment and then be released. I think we're getting a little bit better at understanding the need for continuing care. But that is a relatively new concept when it comes to the treatment of addiction. We used to think you could send somebody away from 30 days and then they were fixed, and that's just not the case. Ongoing recovery and support is a year, many-year process.
Many years. Yeah. I wonder if that statement you just made might dissuade someone from getting into treatment. You know, if I'm using drugs and I feel out of control, but I got the drugs to make me feel better, and I hear that the treatment is many years, well, thanks anyway.
Well, I think people feel better generally when they're in treatment than when they're out of treatment. So staying addicted is a many-year thing, too.
That's true. Okay, I'll change my mind. I'll get into treatment. I read once where all pain lights up in the same part of the brain.
I believe that's true.
Physical pain that we just talked about, emotional pain like depression, anxiety, mm-hmm. lights up in the same part of the brain. So your work is mostly with young people.
I've worked with both young people and adults.
So what are you seeing about, you know, what are they bringing in? We're talking about dual diagnosis here.
Mm-hmm. If you're talking about young people in particular, I think one of the things to be aware of is that adolescence is a high-risk period. So it's a period when adolescent brains are developing such that stimulation, exciting things, that part of the brain's really well-developed, and you know, you'll see adolescents. They are, you know, a lot of the time interested in risk and great stimulation. But the part of the brain that helps you put on the brakes is not fully developed. So it puts them at risk, generally speaking, to sort of seek out positive things and overlook sometimes the long-term negative consequences. So just in terms of making that initial decision to use, It can be that there's some painful things going on emotionally, anxiety or depression, but it can also be social awkwardness, peer pressure, a need to fit in.
You're talking about drug use mm-hmm. here, and a lot of kids use drugs.
Indeed.
Who becomes addicted and why? Who's at most risk?
Boy, I wish there were a simple answer to that question. It's really very complicated. There are a series of factors that make it more risky that a child will develop a problem, and there are protective factors. And I wish they could be neatly summarized, but it's not. I mean, some of the protective factors have, you know, good family relationships, although substance use can develop in places where there are great family relationships. Doing well in school, having a lot of other rewarding activities. But again, it's not like you can look at any of those protective factors and say, okay, my kid's safe. Risk factors, you know, have to do with traumatic events and peer pressures and, you know, getting in with the wrong crowd, not doing well in school, those kinds of things.
You're listening to a special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, From Headlines to Hope in the Opioid Epidemic. You can find out more about Bruce and Ginny Murray's foundation honoring their son on our website. Coming up, more from Dr. Kimberly Kirby of the Treatment Research Institute and Charles Wolfe, Director of Outpatient Services at LivingGrown. Plus, one person's road to recovery that came with a business plan. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back. I'm Larry Roebling. Welcome back to this special edition of Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. The opioid epidemic, from headlines to hope. Dr. Dan spoke with parents, professionals, and individuals in recovery about what can lead to successful recovery. Devin Reeves is the founder and director of the Brotherly Love House, a recovery-focused living environment. But first, he had to get sober.
Devin, I want to hear a little bit about your story. When you got started, you know, I'm looking at you now, you know, you look great. So tell me what leads up to this.
You know, I think there is no rhyme or reason who is going to be afflicted by the disease of substance use disorder. For me, I just wanted to fit in. And that's why I used drugs for the first time. I was in a new town. The cool kids were doing it. Do you want to do it? Sure do. And that pattern continued throughout high school. And as my drug use increased, the consequences increased. And eventually, I guess probably 2005, I was kicked out of Drexel University and lost a full ride to the five-year MBA program because I like drugs more than I like going to school, apparently.
And then what?
Well, I floated around for a while. I engaged in some different entrepreneurial activities. And eventually, on August 20th, 2007, I woke up from an overdose at the hospital at the University of Pennsylvania. My mother, a drug and alcohol counselor, were standing over me with all the accoutrements of my disease and said, you know, what happened? You know, you need to get help. And I eventually agreed to get help. And I went away to a treatment center. I was really lucky we had the resources for me to go to a treatment center, a good treatment center. And I was able to get long, quality care.
What do you mean long?
Well, I was in treatment for 3 months.
We usually hear about 28 days.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was really lucky. My mother is a doctor. And she talked to some friends of hers. And they informed her that I might need a little bit more time in the oven than some other people. And that's what I did. And she said, you're going to stay down there and you're going to do everything they say or you're out of the family. And that's not advice that I give to parents today. But at the time, that's exactly what I needed to hear. And when I said, okay, I did the 90 days. I'm going to come home now. And she said, no, you're going to a recovery residence. And I went to the recovery residence.
How old were you?
I was 24 when I got sober.
All right. So she's calling the shots here.
Oh, yeah.
You're over 21.
Yeah.
You're taking the shot. So it says something about you and your mind here.
Yeah. I think something we don't talk about in recovery a lot, specifically recovery research, is culture. You may not be able to see it by looking at me, but I'm Italian on my mother's side and I was raised by a single mom. So I am, you know, very Italian. And when your mother says something, you know, that's what you do. And when she told me, listen, you're going to do what I say, you're out of the family, I knew what that meant, and I wasn't willing to risk that.
So as the story continues,
after I got into recovery in South Florida, I moved into a recovery residence, and I was working as a stock boy at the beauty supply shop, working 50 hours a week for minimum wage. While I was happy to have good, clean, honest work, that kind of sucked. And somebody said to me, like, you know, you seem like a fairly intelligent guy. Maybe you should go back to college. So I did. And then when I was in college, one of my professors said, you should probably go to graduate school.
You went over to the dark side. You became a social worker.
Yeah, well, I realized a lot of fine social workers helped me to get where I am today.
Good for you. So tell me about Brotherly Love House, because you're the director of that.
Yeah, I'm the owner, operator. My last year at the University of Pennsylvania, I took a class with this really smart guy named Richard Estes called Strategic Planning and Resource Development. we were supposed to write a strategic plan for our internship. I said, nope, I'm going to do it for my own business. He goes, okay, sounds great. So I wrote a strategic plan on opening and operating the first 3 years of a recovery residence. And I got an A in the project, and I made some changes, and that became my prospectus to investors. And I shopped around to investors. I talked about social impact and investment, not only financially, but in our community. And I was able to find two investors that believed in me, believed in what I was doing. They were sympathetic to the cause. We bought the house the summer after graduate school.
What is the program? What's it do?
Sure. So Brotherly Love House is a level two recovery residence. Mostly that's a place where guys are going to live after they get out of some type of substance use disorder treatment. And I'm going to help launch them back into society, help them find a job, help them get connected to the local recovery community, things like that. In America, there's a real divide between the haves and the have-nots. Obviously, we all know about that. But the white kid from the suburbs goes to the $30,000 a month treatment program because the parents can write the check. The kid from North Philly, he's not even going to treatment. He's going to the Youth Study Center in West Philly because he can't afford a lawyer. And even if he was lucky enough to not be railroaded into the jail system, the treatment options available to him are so slim, and none of them are good. And that's what we're talking about here. We have a lack of equity in opportunity to recover.
I'm hearing whispers of that MBA in the background here. I want to switch gears here for a minute. And the more I research this area of opiate addiction, the more I hear about medication in a way I've never heard about medication with any other addiction. One person actually said not to use medication can be considered malpractice. Why medication and what medication? Kimberly?
I think you hear about medication in opiate dependence problems more than others. Our pharmacology is best developed in that area. There have been attempts to develop medications for other kinds of substance use. We've happened to, you know, be more competent at it when it comes to opiates. And there are a variety of medications. Probably one of the oldest ones is methadone. Methadone is an opiate-type drug. There are a couple of opiate-type drugs that are available to treat it. And to some extent, historically, that may have given medication a bad rap because it's replacing one opiate with another opiate. There are good reasons to do that. Methadone is a very smooth-acting opiate. It prevents people from having the highs and the lows, prevents them from having to seek drugs to get four hits of heroin a day. I mean, so it also gets rid of needles, which was very, very important when HIV first came on the scene, and it still is important for that reason. But there have been newer drugs developed that are not really a direct opiate replacement. There's a number of medications that are a combination of opiate drug and opiate blocker. And so that reduces their liability a little bit. Then there are a set of drugs that have come out recently that are opiate blockers. They're very helpful once somebody gets detoxified. It can help them to stay off of drugs. And it's also very important for reducing overdose.
Charlie, you're not a researcher per se, you're a clinician. So just from a clinical perspective, what are the therapies that you have found to be most effective and least effective, if you can answer it?
Yeah. So for me, I think it's a matter of using evidence-based practices. It's not just one therapy style. It's not that I could sit here and say Freudian psychoanalysis works or cognitive behavioral therapy. There's no one answer. But what I can tell you, my experience is a cognitive behavioral approach integrated with motivational interviewing techniques has been successful for me in therapy process. As far as recovery outcomes, remission outcomes, it's best when coupled with some form of peer support, adjunct or parallel to the therapy process.
So here's the deal. You're talking about evidence-based mm-hmm. therapies. The only standard we had for decades in treating any kind of addiction has been 12-step program, and that's not evidence-based. It can't be evidence-based because it's anonymous.
Dan, if I may, we are starting to see the recovering community come out of the shadows, if that's a good way to explain it, of anonymity and come out as a group of people with one common bond. Like when we look at information coming out of PROACT and PROA and other agencies and the movie Anonymous People, where approximately 24 million people are in, have came out and identified themselves as in long-term recovery, 12-step programs are one vessel upon which people find and sustain their recovery. Bill Wilson, one of the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, even said, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is I'm paraphrasing his quote, but is a path to recovery. It's a way of staying sober that worked for us, but it is not the only. You know, so there are various avenues to get to recovery.
Yeah, and back then there weren't a lot of options.
No, there weren't.
Yeah, I don't want to minimize the efficacy of 12-step programs. I mean, people in my family has saved their lives, and many people I love dearly. It's saved their lives. But what I hear a lot is people who disavow that program get criticized because they're not, quote, working the program. Devin, I had said earlier that there was no research. Is there research?
We need to understand the social service part of science is not like chemistry. It's not hard science. So it's harder to look at things like behavioral health interventions the way we do something static like this temperature is 28 and it will always be 28. But there is a lot of great research coming out of Harvard University by John Kelly and some other people. But the problem is that people in recovery in an anonymous program don't want to be part of the system's research. And that's why it's maybe not as broadly known. But it's important for people to know that 12-step fellowships are highly, highly successful. So I don't have the research study in front of me. But we know is that people that are actively participating in a 12-step program are more likely to stay sober than people that are getting no peer support. Recovery is something that doesn't happen in a vacuum. Substance use disorder is something that we do alone. In our rooms, we drink alone, we use drugs alone, we're totally isolated. The opposite of that isolation is the human connection you find in a 12-step fellowship. You have a sponsor, you have this group of peers that are holding you accountable, that are calling you up and saying, hey, Devin, I haven't seen you in a while. Let's go to a meeting together. How could that not be good? I think the problem is to say AA is the only way. You know, I'm not the recovery police. You know, I go to the 12-step fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. I like NA, right? We give hugs, not handshakes. That's really cool to me. But going to church on Sunday is also a huge part of my recovery program. And I think my recovery program would probably be a little bit better if I could exercise more and lose some weight. But that's about wellness, big W. And that's where I'm at in my life now.
Thank you.
Yes, and sir.
I do want to tell you that you're not getting a hug from me. Because I saw you hacking and coughing over there.
Yeah.
So, Robert Ashford, tell us when you began using drugs.
15 was when I had my first drink and subsequently and very quickly had the first foray into smoking marijuana and using other illicit substances as well.
Tell me about the progress. Did you have family? Did you have any help?
So it took 10 years for me to be in a place where I even wanted to get help. And at various points along the way, as my parents began to identify, and how could they not with the amount of substances I was using and the frequency as I got older, and they did not take the approach that we've talked about today. It wasn't the loving, non-condescending. It was a lot of anger. As a matter of fact, I come from a long line of fathers and grandfathers that have alcohol use disorders or did and died at a young age from it. So lack of understanding, I think, contributed to all that, but it was more, not that I got hit, but I'm going to smack you down until you get better. So the help wasn't what we would consider help that would help somebody enter into recovery. What it really took for me over the 10 years that I actively used substances was the criminal justice system. So I've had 3 DUIs in the state of Texas. Never got in trouble for my illicit substance use, but with alcohol. And the 3rd DUI in Texas is a felony. And with the first 2, they send you to do a screening and an assessment. It's really easy to lie on those. And if you're somebody that has an active substance use disorder, you get really good at manipulating situations. But the 3rd DUI, as I was sitting in the holding cell after spending a year trying to get into recovery through kind of grassroots or fellowships, which didn't work for me, I decided that I wanted to go to treatment. It did help with the criminal justice proceedings. I'm here, so I'm not in prison, which I very well could have been. But making that decision of my own volition and then having people that I hadn't alienated around me, family, friends, loved ones, that when I said I was ready to go to treatment, we found treatment.
Got a question, might be too personal and you don't have to answer it. We're talking about dual diagnosis. Did you have other things going on, anxiety disorder, depression?
Almost 80% of us that have substance use disorders also have co-occurring mental health disorders, and I'm one of those 80%, like so many others. And it started as a young age. I was on antidepressants, Paxil, from I believe it's 16 and 17. Was not medication compliant and didn't get treatment for that, but that was the first diagnosis of it going on. Part of the story we haven't really talked about is my father passed away when I was 15 from alcohol-related consequences and being overweight and a smoker. That trauma, coupled with the chemical imbalance and the depression, the general anxiety disorder, all of this kind of developed and the PTSD from that really kind of coalesced into I'm using substances to fit in and be a part of a peer group that I didn't necessarily know if I belonged to. Call it self-medication, just call it trying to survive, was to use substances to deal with both trauma, the substance use disorder I had, and then all the mental health consequences.
What are you doing for your depression now?
So I'm actively in recovery. And when if I was introducing myself out in the world and when I speak to other families or friends, college students, I'm a person in long-term recovery from co-occurring disorders. What that means for me is that I follow an abstinence-based program of recovery for my substance use, and then I engage in ongoing therapy for my mental health concerns. So as I exited treatment, I got a bipolar type 1 diagnosis, NOS, for general anxiety disorder and severe depression disorder. Those two I'd no longer take medications for. I stopped at about year 2. No longer take lithium or anything else for my bipolar type 1 diagnosis either. So what mental health recovery looks like today is that behavioral health therapy weekly, but then also diet, exercise, peer recovery support services, both for my mental health and substance use. It's an ongoing and it's a lot of work. I can tell you today that no matter how much work that is, though, I think the comment was made before that treatment or recovery is a multi-year process, and it absolutely is. I would say lifelong, but the work that I put into my recovery is just as hard as I worked to get substances when I was in active use.
Over all of your treatment, what would you say helped you the most?
I think it's a two-part answer, and one is that the counselors I had access to were well-trained, and without that, it wouldn't have mattered. If that therapeutic alliance hadn't been built, no treatment would have worked. So I think that's the first answer that's important. The second is that I wasn't a person that they put into a box and said this one-size-fits-all approach is going to work. I had access to CBT, DBT, family-centered therapy. And of all of those modalities and the treatment plan that I had from great providers, the one thing that sticks out to me 4 years later that had a profound impact on my ability to engage in the recovery process was the trauma work that I did with a one-on-one counselor around my father and his passing. You know, I remember part of that therapy was taking a brick and writing down everything that I was resentful for, angry for, which happened to be the church, my father, family, all of these things. And she had me go outside the treatment center and smash it. I remember just yelling out in angst and crying, and that release of all this pent-up emotion that was spurred by her training, her expertise, and knowing what I needed, and looking at me like a human being that needed an individual approach, I think saved my life. If I didn't have that therapist, I don't know what would have happened, but I'm grateful for it.
So I want to make a loud and clear announcement to every therapist and would-be therapist who's listening to this show. What you just said, treat patients first. You have your bag of tricks, you have your scientifically proven research, treat patients first.
Absolutely.
Look them in the eye and care about them.
And I think, Dan, you know, if I may, to go further than just the therapist or the future clinicians listening, but also to all of your audience, family members, people still using, people like me in recovery and others are not addicts or alcoholics or substance abusers. We're humans that have a disease, a substance use disorder. And if you can look at us and treat us like we're human first, it becomes much easier to engage in the process of helping people get well. As soon as the stigma, and it's not really stigma, it's discrimination, when you label people these things, addicts, alcoholics, abusers, it's really hard to get well. So taking that approach that anybody you deal with, anybody dealing with this epidemic as a human, is an important characteristic to have.
Sharing their stories of recovery with Dr. Dan were Robert Ashford, Master of Social Work intern at the Brotherly Love House, and Devin Reeves, who is the founder and director of the house. Coming up next, learning to communicate with an active addict and recognizing when they are most likely to get into treatment. I'm Larry Roebling, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to this Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. We've been talking about treatment for opioid addiction with Charles Wolf, Director of Outpatient Services for Livingram, and Dr. Kimberly Kirby of the Treatment Research Institute and Rowan University.
A relatively low percentage of people addicted to opioids actually get into treatment. You've done a good deal of investigation into ways parents can help children get into treatment. You talk specifically about a program called CRAFT, C-R-A-F-T. Mm-hmm. What does that stand for and what's the program?
It stands for Community Reinforcement and Family Training. Comes up with a nice little acronym, CRAFT. And it basically is an approach that helps train parents or other family members. This has also been used with spouses to develop some communication skills and other skills of interacting with the person with the substance use problem that will help reduce some of the conflict in the relationship and also help them recognize opportunities where the person might be more receptive to suggestions of treatment. And then also to make the suggestion in a way that doesn't push the person away, but that they can actually hear.
How do I have to communicate? What do I have to say? What should I not say?
This particular communication skills that we teach aren't specific to what to say and what not to say in the way that we instruct them. So there are things like be brief. Try not to bring in old stuff. Stick to the point. If you get off point or you start pulling up old stuff, you've lost the person. Be specific. So you need to be very clear about what you're asking the person to do and to stay positive in your communication with them.
So what does that sound like? Say my son is 17 years old and he's abusing drugs. I have discovered in all my research that neither anger, nagging, or guilt are very effective interventions.
They are not. So let's come up with a situation. You have a 17-year-old son, and he comes home one night and he's been drinking.
We'll call him Little Danny for the moment.
Okay.
and he comes home. He's been drinking, and he smokes a lot of pot. But now I've got reason to believe he's using hard drugs.
Okay. So how do you handle this? Part of it is trying to approach Danny in a way that is positive and to the point. So, Danny, I am very concerned about you. I noticed that you came in late the other night. I am really worried about what's going on. I know you've been drinking and smoking. I'm worried that there's more going on. And saying it in a way where you're expressing your concern and feeling for Danny, you are not accusing, because what you're just saying is, I'm worried. You're not bringing up old issues or asking if it has to do with the fact that something else happened in the family, maybe grandma died. You just really stick to the point.
And you're also talking about you. You're worried.
Yes.
I often say to parents, though, and spouses, the reason we get so exasperated or angry or frightened or whatever we feel is because we love this child so much. We lose touch with that emotion behind all of the anger and the fear. We lose touch with how much we love that child. If we can come from that place, this loved one that's in trouble here, and we love them dearly.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I only mentioned three of the skills. There's actually seven, and some of them have to do with express your feelings. Mm-hmm. And part of that is helping the parent get back in touch with their feelings. Because they're very mixed. There's so much anger. There's so much frustration. But there's also so much love.
Yeah. So that's CRAFT. Does this work with adults?
Oh, yes. Yes. In fact, it was initially developed for spouses. And just in the last 5-6 years, we have done a trial to make sure that it also works with parents and their kids. And I think the basic strategy can work in any situation. One of the things that is challenging is that it's much harder for this to work if you are not living close to your loved one. So a lot of the time, if you're seeing the person frequently, you have more contact and a better chance for influence. If somebody's far away, I might suggest a different type of approach.
Charlie, I'm going to turn to you. Tough love. We used to hear about that years ago. I would imagine if it was a very effective intervention, we'd still be hearing about it today. We know these dramatic interventions that they have TV shows about. They are, in fact, dramatic, but they don't work either.
Right.
So what do you recommend?
Just to build off Kraft, communication is, you know, has an intrinsic value, and not just communication, but the right type of communication. Again, to me, tough love is almost, you know, if you look at it from a certain point of view, it's like a last resort. But I prefer to me, it's about working with the parent to begin with and getting them to a place to where whatever it is that they say or ask that they're comfortable with themselves. So, and I look at not just, you know, as a therapist, I don't just look at like what magical questions I could ask them or insights that they could reach, but I like to look at what resources are in the community. Like, how can I hook them up with an Al-Anon or a Nar-Anon or some type of family support group where they get that peer-based intervention as well, like talking with other parents. This is their experience. This is how they came to have the strength to stay question-focused as opposed to statement-focused. Like, I know you're using, I know you, this. And, you know, and that all that's going to do is raise defensiveness, resistance, ambivalence, whatever keyword you want to use there. But I think a lot of it is getting the parent to a place to where they're able to be an objective, as best as they can, participant in an intervention or discussion.
Yeah. I want to come back to you, Kimberly, on with this program, Kraft. I mean, it sounds wonderful. And once it is effective and the child or the adult is ready for treatment, big question is there treatment out there? What's available in the community, more so for children than adults?
Mm-hmm. It's tough. There are treatment programs out in the community. We had actually proposed to do some research thinking that the treatment programs were more robust than many of them are. So many of the programs do not have a large census of kids. Sometimes it's difficult to even assess them because a lot of the time it's not a formatted program the way you see with adults. But there are many things that parents can be looking at if they're wanting to look for a good treatment program. We actually developed a resource guide for parents to ask, questions to ask treatment programs, and it's available at the Treatment Research Institute's website.
Is Kraft available? I know training is difficult to get. There's not many people in the Philadelphia that know it.
Yeah, I'm not sure that there are many Kraft-certified trainers in Philadelphia. I know there are a few because we've certified several through the Treatment Research Institute. Most of them have been certified for research purposes, though. I know that there are some places around the country where they do provide Kraft training for parents. The closest one that I know of might be in New York City. But we've also recently, because of this problem, we developed an online training program that uses the Kraft principles. So that's commercially available
for parents. That's what I was hoping to hear.
Okay, yes, it is available. What I will say is that the online version of this is currently, we're under pilot studies to evaluate it. So whereas I can say there's good research showing the effectiveness of Kraft when it's done in purpose, I don't actually have those data in hand now. I can say that everything on the website is based on what we know from doing it in person.
Well, hopefully, with the help of the six of you who have contributed to today's show, we've seen the humanity behind the substance abuse. So I have to thank all of you for coming out, for the work you do, for what you've been through, and for the work you're about to do. So thank you. Thank you. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's the Commissioner of Health in Baltimore City. She talked about their ambitious program to save lives from opioid overdose. Here's that conversation. Everything I read about this national crisis says that on the average, 1 in 10 people seek treatment. Now, you come from an urban perspective, and I understand out in the rural district, geographic access is a problem. But why in the city? Why only 1 in 10 in the city are seeking treatment?
If I may make a slight correction, it is that 1 in 10 patients with substance use disorders are able to get the treatment that they need. It would not be accurate to say that they seek treatment. I see in the ER many patients who are seeking treatment. Unfortunately, they would have to wait weeks or even months to get the treatment that they need. They may also not have the right type of insurance and are unable to get the treatment that is the most appropriate for them, which we would not find acceptable for any other disease. We would not say that 1 in 10 patients with cancer can get chemotherapy or 1 in 10 patients with kidney failure can get dialysis. It's an issue of access, as you well stated. For us in the city, we are increasing access to treatment by going to where people are. Part of the reason, for example, for people not getting treatment is that they cannot access it. They cannot access it because of geography. They cannot access it because of transportation. They cannot access it because they don't know what resources are available to them. We just started having a 24/7 phone hotline where we immediately connect someone into treatment for any addiction or mental health issue. Sometimes that treatment still will be in days or weeks, but at least we have an immediate connection into treatment anytime, 24/7, regardless of insurance, regardless of ability to pay. We're also starting a number of other treatment access programs, including through mobile programs like vans. And we're working directly with both law enforcement and with our hospital so that individuals can immediately get directed to care. We are starting a program based off of Seattle's lead program, Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion, where individuals caught with small amounts of drugs will be offered treatment instead of incarceration. Finally, we seek to employ those who are in recovery themselves. We strongly believe that people are not problems to deal with, that they are solutions to every problem, and that people in recovery themselves can be the best messengers to talk about the disease of addiction, to talk about the process of recovery, about the treatments that are available. And we hire individuals in recovery to work on our needle exchange vans, to work as outreach workers. And we believe that this is a strategy that will increase treatment and also will continue our narrative of addiction being a disease and that treatment exists and recovery is possible.
Have you been able to measure how effective these programs are?
We started these programs last year. Effectiveness is in part measured by the number of lives that we have saved. The fact that we have, as of last count, 531 people whose lives were saved because of lay people, not just paramedics and doctors and nurses, but neighbors and friends and family members saving their lives. I mean, I can't imagine any job that I'll have that will be more directly impactful than saving, than having policies and services that directly save so many lives. We also know from our needle exchange program, which I know that Philadelphia also has a very successful program, our needle exchange program has reduced the percentage of people with HIV from IV drug use from 64% to 8% since starting this program a couple of decades ago. There is a lot more progress for us to be made when it comes to increasing access to treatment and saving lives. But we are doing what we can with extremely limited resources because we know that this is a critical public health priority for all of our residents in the city of Baltimore and across the country.
This has been a Voices in the Family special with Dr. Dan Gottlieb. You can find more of Dr. Dan's conversation with Baltimore Commissioner of Health, Dr. Lena Wen, on our website, along with links to programs discussed on today's show. Thank you to Dr. Kimberly Kirby of the Treatment Research Institute and Professor Researcher in the Department of Psychology at Rowan University. Charles Wolf, Director of Outpatient Services for Livengren, and Bruce and Ginny Murray, founders of the Alex Murray Intensive Care Program at Livengren. Thanks to Devin Reeves and Robert Ashford for sharing their stories of recovery. If you'd like to be part of our live audience at our next taping, keep an eye on the WHYY events page for more information. And talk to us on Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. We'd love to hear from you. The engineers for today's show were Al Banks and Diana Martinez. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of WHYY Audio Content. Mike and Scott is Voices executive producer. I'm Larry Roebling, producer of Voices in the Family. And Dr. Dan Gottlieb is the host.
Have a good week, my friends. And the week after that. And the week after that. And the week after that.